History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. This Day in History, April 12th. On this day in 1861, rebel forces bombard Federal Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, an event recognized by historians as the start of the American Civil War. Despite President Abraham Lincoln's intentions to keep the Union together, South Carolina seceded just weeks after his election, and several other southern states followed in the subsequent months. South Carolina was a hotbed of pro-slavery supporters, and when the government refused to evacuate the fort, troops under the newly formed Confederate States of America began an assault in what would become America's bloodiest and most devastating war, which ultimately claimed over 600,000 lives. And in 1945, President Franklin D. Roosevelt died as World War II was still raging. His vice president, Harry Truman, was sworn in, and he was immediately faced with the overwhelming responsibility of bringing an end to the global conflict. After Truman took the oath of office, the urgency of the moment was apparent, as he was bluntly told that the immensity of the problems facing the nation were now his to resolve. There are many museums focusing on history around our nation. Several have been in operation for a few decades, others for almost two centuries. A recent trend in museums around the country is a focus on a particular topic or era in our history, and the Museum of the American Revolution in downtown Philadelphia will do just that. As Philadelphia was one of the cradles of liberty, alongside Boston, in the mid to late 1770s, the location is perfect for what is destined to become America's most fascinating new venue for people who want to learn about our rich heritage. The museum will open its doors on April 19th, the 242nd anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord, the shots heard round the world, which started the American Revolution. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Scott Stevenson, their Vice President of Collections, Exhibits, and Programming, an important part of the team there at the new museum, who will be showcasing their varied exhibits to an interested public. The displays include George Washington's camp tent, his drinking cups, Revolutionary War-era pistols, flags, and related artifacts, as well as a banner to the Marquis de Lafayette, and numerous other fascinating items sure to thrill any history buff. The museum is located just down the street from Independence Hall, so it is likely to become a major attraction for visitors to the area. We're blessed to have Dr. Stevenson to speak with us today to tell us about the new museum. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Gene. It's, as a resident of the Brandywine Valley and a great lover of the show, it's really a pleasure for me to be with you here.
Well, thank you so much. Now, Scott, tell us a little bit about your background. I know you got your PhD from the University of Virginia. What brought you back to the Philadelphia area and interested in this museum?
Yeah, well, I'm actually a native of Pittsburgh, so from Western Pennsylvania. I did my undergraduate work at Juniata College in Central Pennsylvania, and then, as you said, Virginia for my graduate degree. And I was working when I finished my PhD in the late 90s. Started doing a lot of public history work for Colonial Williamsburg, the National Park Service, Pennsylvania Historical Museum Commission, you know, other historical organizations, and eventually worked for the Heinz History Center out in Pittsburgh on a French and Indian War commemoration, 250th anniversary of the French and Indian War. But my family was located out here. My wife is a physician and was working in the Wilmington, Delaware area. So we located out here in the early 2000s, and this wonderful opportunity came about to be part of creating this new Museum of the American Revolution.
I understand that the museum has roots from several years back. In fact, I think I mentioned to you offline that I had met a gentleman on the train on Amtrak riding up to New York, I believe, several years ago, who talked about a Museum of the American Revolution, which was originally planned for Valley Forge. Tell us a little bit about how it ended up downtown.
Sure. Yeah, we actually like to describe ourselves as a century-old startup, because the roots of the museum actually do go back to Valley Forge, to an Episcopal priest named Reverend Herbert Burke, who was the founder of the Valley Forge Historical Society and the Washington Memorial Chapel. So many of your listeners, I'm sure, have been through Valley Forge Park and have seen the wonderful Gothic chapel there. And I'm sure many of them will actually remember visiting the chapel and seeing the relics that were on display there. And so it was Burke's vision to pull a collection of objects together and found a museum that would be dedicated to the early founding period of the nation. And so many of those things were gathered, you know, in the teens and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and all the way through until the 1990s. And it's really in the 90s when the discussion began about taking this collection and actually building a standalone museum. And so it was originally proposed at Valley Forge, and then from about 1999 to the about 2007 or 8, I guess, was proposed to be built on the border of Valley Forge National Historical Park. But in 2009, the organization and the Department of the Interior came up with what we think in retrospect was an absolutely brilliant plan, and that was to do a land exchange. So there were 78 acres owned by the museum that adjoined Valley Forge Park, and that was incorporated into the park and to be preserved forever. And the site of the former visitor center that had been built for the bicentennial down in Philadelphia for Independence Park, which had been replaced by a later building, was received in exchange.
Excellent.
So the museum is at the corner of 3rd and Chestnut, so just two blocks from Independence Hall.
Oh, that's wonderful. I know the crowds down there in the summertime are going to be huge. What is the mission? What is the mission of this new museum?
Well, we really hope to provoke visitors, to help them explore the history and the legacy of the American Revolution. It's our feeling that there are an incredible number of fine institutions, some of them tracing themselves back literally to the time of the Revolution, others created much more recently, that tell the story of particular battles or particular, revolutionary era cities. They may explore social history of the colonial revolutionary period. But there isn't what I would describe as a kind of visitor center for the American Revolution that is a place to get the broad narrative of the story that helps you to link together sites to battlefields or taverns or homes and other historic sites. And so we want to be that sort of first place you go to get context. And equally important for us is also to make sure that people understand the American Revolution as not simply the Revolutionary War. We tell a great story in the exhibitions that we like to say it's a story set in wartime, but we do differentiate the Revolutionary War, which resulted in the achievement of American independence, from a broader story of the creation of the American Republic and the expansion on the promise of ideas about liberty and equality and freedom that are contained in those founding documents. And so it's very much our feeling also that we're a museum that talks about the American Revolution today. We, as an experiment in self-government, we feel we are still living in the American Revolution. And so that a contemporary, forward-looking message is just as important as recounting tales of the founding era.
Excellent. Having just completed my master's degree in American history completed my master's thesis on Alexander Hamilton, I know that this is a museum that I'm going to want to visit very soon. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of very fascinating artifacts there. Speaking of artifacts, just roughly, how many artifacts does the museum have in the collection there?
So we have our core collection is about 3,000 objects, and that includes, works of art, manuscripts, printed works, archaeological materials, et cetera. About 500 of which would be on, will be on display at any given time in the core exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also, when visitors come to the museum after our opening in April, they will also see items on loan to us from a couple dozen both private and institutional lenders. So to kind of expand our story. There, you know, there's always areas in a museum collection that you're not as strong in, mm-hmm. or you want to feature things that maybe don't see the light of day very often. So we've got, you know, some tremendous material from private collections that we've had some very generous lenders who feel that, you know, things that are normally kept in a bank vault or, you know, kept on the walls of their living room might be shared with the public.
Excellent.
So I'm really excited about the material that will be on display.
Will you have any artifacts from, let's say, Mount Vernon, Monticello, Mount Pelier?
Let's see. You're stretching my powers of recall for the moment. We do have a portrait on loan from Mount Vernon. That's actually, ironically, of a British officer, but a really quite remarkable portrait of a young British officer who came with the Brigade of Guards, fought at all the battles of 1776, you know, around New York. He was on the Philadelphia campaign, so literally, you know, marched through Chester County, was in Philadelphia during the British occupation, and then this is a painting that was done just after his return to England during the war.
And where is that from?
Because it shows it's owned by Mount Vernon.
It is by Mount Vernon. Okay, at Mount Vernon. Yeah.
Owned by Mount Vernon.
I know. I know a general who actually fought in the Revolutionary War who now lives in southern Chester County who has a painting of one of his bodyguards that he'd like to maybe consider talking to you about.
well.
General George Washington himself.
Yes. I know exactly who you're talking about.
I've seen the painting, and it appears to be an original. Quite frankly, it's a fascinating item to look at. When you mention all the different artifacts, will you be getting them literally from all around the country?
Absolutely, yes. We've got things from northern New England to Georgia to Indiana. I'd say the eastern half of North America. We've got a tremendous response from folks, historic Deerfield up in Massachusetts, the Virginia Historical Society in Richmond. It's been really very gratifying, the collegiality of other lending institutions. In many cases, you know, us asking them for really core pieces of their collection. For instance, the Concord Museum in Concord, Massachusetts, which is, you know, founded very early in the 19th century and tremendous material. We wanted to tell the story of the fighting at Concord Bridge on April 19, 1775, and could not have put this display together without the generosity of the Concord Museum, which is loaning us a mirror that was actually hanging in the home of Captain David Brown. He was the captain of one of the minute companies there in Concord, and in the famous, there's a famous engraving that many people will know by Amos Doolittle showing the British men, you know, fighting across the bridge at Concord, and literally in the background is David Brown's house. It's actually literally in that lower marshy area next to the bridge.
Oh, that's
that
fascinating.
Mirror was taken off the wall by, you know, a British soldier and thrown out the door and broken. We have in our collection the musket that he carried there on April 19th. So we're reuniting these two objects literally for the first time since, I think, 1805 was the last time these objects were in the presence of one another.
Oh, excellent.
We'll have a piece
of
the Concord Bridge. Yeah, so great stuff, and on and on.
That's great. Well, we're just about to take a brief break for a commercial, but stay with us. We'll be right back after commercial. We're talking with Dr. Scott Stevenson of the Museum of the American Revolution in downtown Philadelphia, scheduled to open in April of this year. We're back with Living History, and we're talking today with Dr. Scott Stevenson of the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. Scott, you've got a lot of interesting things to discuss about the new museum, which, again, will open on April 19th, and it's sure to be a big event in downtown Philadelphia. Now, of course, the significance of the opening date is obvious to any history buff, but was there any discussion about possible other opening dates, for example, like July 4th or what have you?
Well, as the guy who's responsible for making sure all the exhibits are built, the objects are here, and everything's ready to receive visitors, I would have loved July 4th because that would have given me a few extra months.
A couple extra months.
Right. But, of course, April 19th, as the date of the battles of Lexington and Concord and the beginning of the Revolutionary War, has a lot of symbolic power. It also, from a practical point of view, kind of marks the beginning of the spring summer tourist season in historic Philadelphia. And,
right.
You know, one, that's certainly something we wanted to capture and make sure that the most number of people possible would be able to visit the museum in our first year.
As for people listening in across the country, if you haven't visited Philadelphia, you need to get here. And probably the busiest time would be around the July 4th holiday. But this will be open April 19th of this year, 2017. And right down the street is Independence Hall and another wonderful place, the Constitution Center, many other historic structures and buildings all around the area. The Museum of the American Revolution is going to highlight numerous artifacts related to the Revolution. Now, I want to talk about something that I have never seen. I've seen pictures of, but I would love to see up front and close. General George Washington's camp tent. Now, this is his original intact tent, correct?
That's right. That's right. It's a sleeping and office tent. It's a form known as a marquee in the 18th century. And it was one of a pair of tents that Washington used as his sort of mobile field headquarters. So this was this tent that's in the museum's collection that will be on display was used as his private office and sleeping chamber. And then he had another similar size tent, a little bit larger, that he used for dining and for larger meetings. So not used as frequently.
Mm-hmm.
But this office tent was really the only private place Washington had during the war. So one of the interesting things about it is if you drive up and down the East Coast, of course, we're all familiar with the Washington Slept Here historic markers. And oftentimes those are buildings that were used as headquarters for Washington during the Revolutionary War. But we know from correspondence and documentation from the period that it was Washington's practice, even when he was quartered in a private home, that he would have this tent erected in the yard, and that literally acted as his private office. No one would disturb him when he was in there. This is where he would read and write his dispatches. There'd be guards posted there, and no one dare disturb him. And
fascinating.
When I first started to read these descriptions, the image that popped into my mind was the famous picture that your listeners will all know of President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, standing at that desk in the Oval Office, you know, with his head hung. And I just thought about Washington as commander-in-chief and what it meant for a space like that to exist. And so we started only tongue-in-cheek referring to the tent as the first Oval Office.
Yes.
Obviously not directly connected to the design of the White House, but it is an oval-shaped.
Interesting. Do you know if it was pitched, set up at Brandywine?
So we believe that the existing tent is from the second set of marquees that Washington had made at the end of the Valley Forge encampment. So in early 1776 in Philadelphia, actually right across the street, catty corner across Chestnut Street from our front door, there was an upholsterer by the name of Plunkett Fleeson, wonderful name, at the sign of the easy chair.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually provided a set of marquees for Washington, which he appears to have used through the campaign of 1776 and 1777. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as you know, your listeners know, those 2 years, Washington's army is still in the field very late into the year.
Yes.
Actually, in 1776, you know, crossing the Delaware, Christmas Day, you know, fighting through the 10 crucial days into early January 1777, and then the same thing in 1777 after the Battle of Brandywine, campaigning into to the march in to Valley Forge in December. So it appears as though those original tents had just been worn out, rotted, and had to be replaced. And so shortly before Washington's army marches out of Valley Forge in June of 1778, this new pair of marquees is delivered to him.
And that's the one you have, correct?
That's the one that we've got.
Yeah.
So that would have been, you know, the Monmouth campaign all through the rest of the war, for several months in 1781 during the Yorktown campaign. So it saw a lot of amazing history.
Sure. Just describe the tent itself. How big is it? What does it look like?
So it's about 22 feet long when it's set up, maybe about 15 feet, just under 15 feet wide. Made from a kind of light linen canvas. It is divided by some internal partitions actually into three rooms. And so it's from the exterior, it just appears like it's one big sort of oval-shaped tent. Hmm. But it actually has a kind of central room, and then one end of the marquee is a sleeping chamber that had additional layers of insulation, you know, additional liners, and then Washington's camp bed that was set up in the one end. And in the far end from that, which had its own separate entrance, was a space for a valet or a servant. And, of course, Washington was accompanied through the War of Independence by William Lee, who was an enslaved African-American young man who was actually the only African-American enslaved person who was freed directly by Washington's will at the time of his death in 1799, and that was in recognition of his of his service. So he was the other occupant of this kind of canvas home of Washington.
And it's interesting that I think you mentioned it's more of an oval shape rather than the typical square or rectangular shape.
Correct. Yes, it has kind of rounded ends, which plan view has, and because of the way the sides are kind of pulled out, it has a kind of lopsided oval appearance.
Interesting. Now, tell us about some of the other fascinating artifacts in the collection. What are some of your favorites?
Well, oh my goodness. I mean, for a kind of personal connection, there's a pair of English horse pistols that belonged to General Muhlenberg, of course. Mm. Familiar to people from the region as the namesake of Muhlenberg College and Henry Muhlenberg being the founder of the Lutheran Church in America. And so his son, John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg, was a Lutheran minister. He had actually was in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia when the war broke out, and he becomes the commander of the 8th Virginia Regiment. And I actually later found out after I'd been working for the museum for a while that I have an ancestor who was serving in a German regiment. He was recruited in Pennsylvania, but was serving under Muhlenberg during the Philadelphia campaign. So he was at Brandywine and at the Battle of Germantown. There's an account of Muhlenberg shooting a British officer from horseback during the retreat at the end of the Battle of Germantown. And I actually was able to piece together through muster rolls and other accounts that this ancestor of mine was literally standing right there when this this little incident took place. So when I look at those objects, those pistols, which Muhlenberg in his will left to his oldest son and described them as the brass barreled pistols I carried in the Revolution. At one point lost them during the war and advertised for them and described them. So they're very, very well documented.
Interesting.
So for an object that has kind of a personal connection for me, that's very high up
there.
That's
interesting. Yeah. Curious, with that link, are you in the Sons of the American Revolution?
I am a member of the Society of the Descendants of Washington's Army at Valley Forge. Hoping to have time once I finish the museum to maybe get my SAR membership in and that sort of thing. But I also, like many Americans, I have a side of my family that is from Ellis Island as well. And so, I have a loyalist ancestor. So for me, it just has so much significance for the museum that we are both about the kind of folks who can trace their lineage back, but also have a message of inclusion about how, one of the great things about this nation is that we're not bound together because we're all of the same race or religion, or creed, but that we subscribe to ideas about self-government and liberty and freedom embodied in those founding documents.
Absolutely.
And we're a place where being American is something you can actually become. It's a lot harder to become French or Chinese.
Yes, that's exactly right. And, we've been discussing the new Museum of the American Revolution. What can visitors expect to see right when they walk into the museum? What's the first exhibit they'll see or a set of artifacts?
Oh, wow. Well, I'll tell you, much of the visitor experience happens on our second floor. We got about 16,000 square feet of core exhibition in 16 galleries and theaters. And actually, the very first experience you have when after you've seen the orientation film and go upstairs, you walk into a room that's kind of a circular room with surround sound and projection. And we have recreated the moment on July 9th of 1776 when a group of soldiers and sailors in New York who had heard the Declaration of Independence read for the first time that day snuck down into what's now the Bowling Green, so down in Lower Manhattan, right near where the famous Bull on Wall Street sculpture is, still standing, and they tore down a statue of King George III, an equestrian statue that was, gilt lead that stood on a high marble pedestal. And so one of the things we hope to do by sort of bringing folks into that very kind of populist moment is to, one of the things we suffer from now in the way we remember the revolution is often I think we have trouble reaching audiences because their image of it is a bunch of middle-aged guys who look like me with powdered wigs looking at pieces of paper on the table, and they don't necessarily see themselves reflected in the founding of the nation. And so we thought by showing that this was a populist moment, that ordinary, it was an ordinary person's revolution as much as it was, the great minds and thinkers. It was, of course, them as well.
Yes.
We also wanted to, have this kind of very exciting get your adrenaline up. And then we ask four big questions. And these are the four questions that frame the entire gallery. So it's, how did people become revolutionaries? How did the revolution survive its darkest hour? What was revolutionary about the war, and what kind of nation did the revolutionaries create?
Mm-hmm. That's very,
that's
very interesting.
Your big ideas,
thought-provoking questions. Yes, and where can our listeners get more information about the museum? Tell us about the website. What is the website?
Sure. So the website is www.amrevmuseum.org. So that's AMREV. museum.org. Frankly, if you just type into your search engine Museum of the American Revolution Philadelphia, you'll be taken to the website. We have previews of some of the exhibits. We've got a gallery of some selections of wonderful artifacts from the collection. You can get information about becoming a member, and this is if people are interested in visiting. We're anticipating a lot of crowds this year. The tickets will actually go on sale. There are time tickets for the museum on February 22nd.
Oh, excellent.
But for folks who would like to get a preview, actually you can become a founding member, and there's information on the website, and there's a members preview weekend. It's actually Easter weekend, the 15th and 16th of April, and particularly for people in the region who might want to become an individual or a family member, they'll be invited to that preview weekend, which is really a great deal.
Excellent. So it's amrevmuseum.org. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh,
it was wonderful, wonderful having you on the show. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday, April 19th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be speaking with Phyllis Schrecka about her two great books titled Chad's Ford, Then and Now. Thank you all for tuning in today to Living History.